morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February the 22nd. And here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The main opposition Unity Party in Liberia has announced its withdrawal from an opposition coalition formed ahead of next year's general elections.
We operated the collaboration based on meetings and attending activities of the collaboration. All of the meetings that were cited by the Unity Party and its leadership were boycotted by members of the Alternative National Congress.
That is Muhammad Ali, National General Secretary of the Unity Party. A Mogadishu-based think tank has reported that the militant group Al-Shabaab spends $24 million on purchasing weapons.
We established that the group collects $180 million a year. This could have increased over the past year as it seeks to, you know, expand its tax base and diversify.
Samira Guide is the executive director of Hilal Institute, and Zimbabwe's government has announced a $377 million project to deal with the housing shortage in the country. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. In Liberia, the main opposition Unity Party has announced its withdrawal from an opposition coalition formed ahead of next year's general election. The coalition, the opposition says, aims to defeat incumbent President George Weah to make him a one-term president. But analysts say the withdrawal of the Unity Party shows the opposition is in crisis ahead of the election. This is after the All-Liberian Party, led by Benoni Ure, also pulled out of the group. And some observers contend the failure of Weah's opponents to come together could strengthen his re-election prospects. To learn more about the reasons for the withdrawal from the opposition coalition, my colleague Peter Clotty reached the National General Secretary of the Unity Party, Mr. Muhammad Ali.
Our decision to withdraw was based on several facts. The first one is we took over the leadership of the collaboration on October 15, 2021. And in our turnover ceremony to our party, the ANC, which is a constituent party, that is for the Alternative National Congress, refused to participate in the program, contending that they did not participate in the preparatory stages. And that has never happened. The second thing is, we operated the collaboration based on meetings and attending activities of the collaboration. All of the meetings that were cited by the Unity Party and its leadership were boycotted by members of the Alternative National Congress. The third factor is that one of the constituent institutions part of the collaboration, the Liberty Party, had an internal conflict that has divided that party. It made it difficult to invite the Liberty Party as a unit to any given function of the CPP or any meeting. And once you do not have a single party attending a function or a meeting, that means that the collaboration cannot meet, decisions cannot be taken, because at least one person from every organ of every party involved should be present at every given meeting.
Why were some of these challenges so egregious to surmount, such that it breaks down what you have built, as some people suggest, your best bet in posing a significant threat?
Yes. The thing is, Peter, we can only hold together when we work together, when we show respect for each other. We cannot function as a unit if one or two institutions are not respecting the norms that we've operated by from the beginning. The collaboration is only good as when its members decide to work together in unison like we did in the past. The Unity Party has cooperated with every leadership, beginning with Mr. Ure to Mr. Cummings to Senator Yomi Kanga Lawrence.
Liberians are suggesting that if this coalition breaks down, you are effectively guaranteeing the re-election of incumbent President George Weah's second term. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that is not a fair assessment. Peter, people are going to vote President Weah in for a second term or voting out based on the performance of his government. Nobody is going to vote because the collaboration crumbled or the collaboration held together. Now, we can even hold together as a collaboration if President Weah and his government performs splendidly to the satisfaction of the Liberian people. They will re-elect him. And as it stands, I do not see how he could possibly get re-elected because the social fabrics of this country are just non-existent. The economy is performing very poorly. People cannot afford to feed their families. People can't afford to send their children to schools. You see people of school-going age, university students, are all out of school because they cannot afford. Not a single occasion has this government been able to tell the Liberian people how many jobs they've created, even though they promised the creation of 200,000 jobs every year for 5 years. They've not made a single report on that.
So where does the Unity Party go from here, especially with reports that it will be impossible for the Unity Party to defeat incumbent President George Weah if you go it alone?
So the thing is, we are not going it alone. We have never gone it alone. Why in this process? We are already building consensus. We are already building partnerships with other political parties and other individuals who are very influential in the Liberian society. As a matter of fact, two of the other parties that are in the collaboration, the All Liberian Party of Mr. Yuri, the Liberty Party of Senator Nyombi Kanga Lawrence, are already with us. In fact, they did their withdrawal from the collaboration before the Unity Party.
That was Muhammad Ali, the General Secretary of the Unity Party in Liberia. He was speaking to my colleague, Peter Cloti. Zimbabwe's government has announced a $377 million project to deal with the housing shortage by constructing affordable homes before next year's election. Critics note that such promises often come ahead of election and that many Zimbabweans have been on a housing waiting list for more than a decade. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Sylvester Mutemashinga is one of many Zimbabweans who have no decent place in which to live. For 9 years, he has been living in a structure made mainly of plastic in the Headcliff section of Harare. Mutemashinga says his wish is to get money and build a house to stay in comfortably with family. He says, "I stay with my wife, child and nephew, but because of difficulties of life, jobs are hard to come by. The small jobs we get do not pay enough. You end up getting money just for subsistence." Across the road in Borodale, nice homes are being built and some are on sale to the upper class. Kudzai Chatiza is a professor in rural and urban planning at the University of Zimbabwe. He says the poor find it difficult to build or even to secure property because of the high cost of construction.
The cost of putting up structures needs to be looked at, and the cost of finance needs to be looked at as well, because our mortgage rates are between 40 and 50%. So it's already an economy that is unable to build houses at scale because of some of the costs of the basic ingredients that we require to put up a house.
The government says it is aware of the housing problem. Monica Mchangwa, the Minister of Information, says the government has started constructing houses nationwide at more than 50 sites. She says they should be ready for occupation by next year. She says the construction is part of efforts to clear the waiting list for homes, which has grown to more than 1.5 million.
The sites are expected to avail 324 blocks of flats, yielding a cumulative 5,284 units, and this is just for the emergency settlements. And the total cost required for construction of flats up to the 2023 amounts to $377 million.
In the past, similar announcements have been made with elections around the corner. Whatever the outcome, Mutema Shinga says he hopes to get into a decent home soon. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
A Mogadishu-based think tank has reported that the militant group Al-Shabaab has an annual budget of $24 million that it spends on purchasing weapons. Hilal Institute said Al-Shabaab uses various methods in procuring weapons, including direct purchase from local black markets. Samira Guide is the executive director of Hilal Institute. She tells VOA Somali that during the research, they had access to Al-Shabaab's annual budget documentation, which shows that the group collects at least $180 million a year.
This research was a follow-up to the research work that we have previously done on Al-Shabaab finances. According to our research last year, 2021, we established that the group collects $180 million a year. This could have increased over the past year as it seeks to, you know, expand its tax base and diversify. For this specific report, though, we got access to Al-Shabaab's budget, annual budget documentation, and also interviewed a wide range of, you know, former Al-Shabaab members, clan leaders, business owners, government officials, and, you know, other civil society members who have direct or indirect knowledge of how this group functions. Just like the FGS, the biggest chunk of its resources is currently being spent on security-related expenses. This, of course, includes wages and operational costs, but Al-Shabaab spends approximately $24 million a year of that $100 million budgeted expenses on just arms procurement.
During their research, Hilal spoke with former Al-Shabaab members, clan leaders, business owners, government officials, and others who had knowledge of how the group functions. Samira says the group has a decentralized system of procuring arms.
What many will find interesting is that while the group is highly centralized in some ways, at the same time it's highly decentralized in some of its activities, such as, you know, the arms procurement. The regular purchases of its weapons and ammunition is without much involvement from its top leadership, unless it's an extraordinary request that may involve, you know, high value purchases or specialist items, or when there's a huge operation to be conducted and that they need more equipment than they would normally require. The group also manufactures, you know, certain types of ammunition and explosives, and a certain amount of its budget goes towards that.
Hilal's researchers found that most of the arms and ammunition purchased by Al-Shabaab came from Yemen.
For the routes and methods of procurement, a number of reports have been done on this, and our report confirmed yet again that, not surprisingly, Yemen is the origin of most of the equipment that Al-Shabaab is using in the battlefield. The group, of course, does procure from the local black market, as well as relying also on, you know, the equipment that it captures from the battlefield when it's confronting AMISOM and the Somali security forces.
She says that due to the arms embargo on the government of Somalia, Al-Shabaab is able to procure arms with relative ease than that of the government.
What is of concern is that, first, it's relatively easy for the group compared to the federal government to acquire weapons both locally and regionally. And this is the same can be said for the federal member states as well. It's quite difficult for them with the arms embargo to procure equipment. Secondly, the group's in-house capabilities to manufacture some ammunition and explosives, even if basic, is highly functional and effective. And then also, the group is able to budget for lethal support. This is an area that the federal government, and I'm sure the federal member states, have difficulty with. They have to rely on donor support for lethal support. This is an area where Al-Shabaab, that doesn't have to provide services, is able to use its vast resources that it extorts from the Somali people to procure equipment.
That was Samira Guide, the executive director of Hilal Institute in Somalia. Dr. Paul Farmer, an American medical anthropologist and physician who was known for bringing healthcare to some of the world's poorest countries, died Monday at the age of 62. A statement from his nonprofit organization said that Mr. Farmer unexpectedly passed away in his sleep in Rwanda. Dr. Farmer was 62 years old. Partners in Health CEO Dr. Sheila Davis said in a statement that Paul Farmer's loss is devastating, but his vision for the world will live on through Partners in Health. And lawyers for Mali's ruling junta says they have taken legal action to get sanctions imposed by West Africa's Monetary Union lifted as the country battles a debt crisis that threatens to wreck the economy. The eight-nation regional monetary authority, IOMOA, on January 9th told all financial institutions under its umbrella to suspend Mali with immediate effect after the junta, which overthrew the president in a coup in 2020, reneged on a promise to hold early elections. And let's stay in West Africa, in Mali, where the announced withdrawal of French and European military forces from Mali has exposed the need to address the crisis in the Central Sahel in a more comprehensive way. That is according to Oxfam. Robin Guittard, the group's influencing coordinator for Oxfam in West Africa, spoke to Ricky Shryok about what the withdrawal means for addressing instability in the country.
Well, what we strongly believe in at Oxfam is that this withdrawal from the European and French forces from Mali is a clear sign of a failure, of almost 10 years of strategies and policies in the Sahel that hasn't been really able to address the situation. Insecurity has been spreading to other countries. The humanitarian situation is catastrophic in the region. It's one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world right now. Hunger is on the increase. And so what we're really recording now is really for the international community, and starting with France, to really take stock of that reality, to rethink approaches and strategies in the region.
Do you at Oxfam feel the strategy was too focused on a military reaction to the situation in the Sahel?
Yeah, exactly. And that's something we've been saying for a number of years, and not just on the Oxfam. The fact that the conflict, the crisis that Sahel is facing are extremely complex. And we can just have like a narrow military approach to very complex problem. And there's different layers of complexity in the Sahel crisis, beyond the question of development, as well as the question of inequality, and how a large part of Sahelian population are feeling a deep sentiment of injustices, in particular a huge mistrust within central authorities and from the state authority in particular. What we are seeing is that this broken social contract in Sahelian societies. And of course, soldiers can't address that. So we need military security responses, but we can't just rely only on military responses. We need a much more comprehensive approach, and as well to take into account the question of governance. And that is one element that we think has been totally like not really enough taken into account, in particular by France. And when we see the recent events, in particular in Burkina Faso, of course, we all need to really look more deeply to that question of governance and how some Sahelian population don't really feel represented in the current governance system.
Can you give me an example in the Sahel of, or specifically maybe in Mali, of something Oxfam has seen that shows how some populations don't feel included in the centralized government system?
I think one of the examples, for example, in how young people are being quite excluded from decision-making processes. And we're in a region which is the youngest population in the world. More than half of the population is under 30. And as well, it's really connected with the question of inequality. For example, when we know that in Mali, only 2 to 3% of children of nomadic community are in school. So they're basically facing a system which is not adapted to their reality.
That was Robin Guittard, Oxfam's influencing coordinator for Oxfam in West Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Paris. Homosexuality is criminalized in more than half of African countries, including in Senegal, where Muslim groups are nonetheless calling for tougher penalties. Sunday, thousands gathered in the capital Dakar to demand longer prison sentences and even death for homosexuals. Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar in Senegal.
A group of men gathered in a circle to set fire to a gay flag and broke out in a chant saying, "Senegal will never accept homosexuality." Others held signs that read, "Senegal says no to homosexuality and we demand an end to the LGBT agenda." The event was organized by ultra-conservative Muslim groups who say homosexuality is being imposed on them by the West and that it threatens their traditional values. Senegal is a 95% Muslim country that already prohibits any indecent or unnatural acts between individuals of the same sex, as written in the penal code. Offenders can be punished with up to 5 years in prison and a fine of between 100,000 to 1.5 million seifa, about $2,500. But anti-gay activists claim the government is lying to them and that the law doesn't actually exist. Others say it doesn't go far enough and that the homosexual should face up to 10 years in prison. A proposed bill that would have increased the prison sentence for homosexual acts to between 5 and 10 years was rejected by lawmakers in January. Ngone Dia is a university student and the head of the women's department at Ansam Jikoyi, the collective of Islamic associations that organized the event. For Molof, the name translates to "Together for the Safeguarding of Values." She says her group wants the government to criminalize homosexuality like they criminalized rape, like they criminalized cattle theft. Dia says they want homosexuals to be imprisoned, even if it's forever. She adds that Senegal is a homophobic country, and her group is proud to say it. Ibrahima Sise, a construction worker, also attended the event. He held a sign in Wolof that translates to, "If you catch a homosexual, kill them." Sise says everyone knows now that Africans are awake. Europeans, he says, mistreated older generations with slavery. But now, he says African youth know what they want and will make their own decisions. He adds, "If you catch a homosexual, kill them." Last May, the Muslim collective held a similar rally that also drew thousands of protesters. In the weeks that followed, LGBTQ activists reported a rise in assaults. When visiting Senegal, some Western leaders have urged local lawmakers to ease restrictions on sexual minorities. Souleymane Diouf is the president and founder of the LGBTQ rights group Free Senegal. He identifies as bisexual and uses a fake name to protect his identity. He says he survived two assassination attempts, which led to him seeking refuge in France. But he says he still receives messages from people who threaten his infant daughter, who is still in Senegal. The problem, he says, is that the youth are being radicalized by terrorist organizations whose influence has spread rapidly throughout the Sahel. He says he risks being assassinated, even in Europe. He says it's just a matter of time for people like him. But Diouf adds this won't stop rights campaigners from raising their voices to say what's happening in Senegal falls within the framework of terrorism, not, in fact, within the framework of a major religion. If Senegal continues down this path, he says, sexual minorities could face genocide. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great day ahead, Africa.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sikus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right